Okay, everyone, it's good to see you. Haven't seen you in a while, so it's good that we can maintain some sense of connection and be able to interact somewhat even without actually being in shul. So I want to just talk a little bit about Pesach. First of all, I wanted to acknowledge everyone's well wishes on the birth of Elisheva Chana. Thank you very much. One person asked me just before we get into the actual Pesach discussion, so somebody asked me to just address briefly what you do about a baby naming when there's no shul. So normally when you have a boy, so you name the boy at the bris. So when you have a girl, you name the girl. If the father gets an aliyah, usually at the earliest possible opportunity, and names the baby during the course of the Misha Beirach that he gets after having the aliyah. So how do you, maybe the girl is going to be without a name for months. There's no official naming. There's no Misha Beirach. How could you name a baby girl? So the answer is that there's nothing magical about the Misha Beirach. That, of course, the Misha Beirach is just a way of publicizing the name. So in the absence of any Misha Beirachs, unfortunately, we just announce the name. And that's that will be her name. And hopefully, very soon, we'll be able to get an aliyah in shul and officially mention the name in the context of a Misha Beirach. But it has absolutely no bearing on the efficacy of the bestowing a name on a baby girl, which is perfectly adequately accomplished just by announcing the name. Okay, so we'll get started with Pesach. And again, I don't think I'm going to be checking my email during the course of the shiur. So if you have a question, just unmute yourself and ask a question. And there's also a function of a chat that if you look at the bottom of your screens, at least here I have the actual Zoom program. So if you click on chat, you can type a question during the course of the shiur if you don't want to ask it verbally and unmute yourself. So the first thing I wanted to mention is that it's one thing we haven't quite gotten to is the idea that you're supposed to start learning about Pesach 30 days in advance of Pesach. So we're a lot less than 30 days in advance of Pesach, so we have to cram a lot of material into a short amount of time. According to many, the only obligation to actually learn about the holidays 30 days in advance, although we try to do it by every holiday, is specifically by Pesach, because Pesach is the holiday with the most rules. So especially, there are a lot of people that are in adverse circumstances this year that they were, you know, there's this whole group, especially on this side of the Heights, of people who would never imagine that they would be making Pesach and now all of a sudden have to make Pesach because they're not allowed to be with parents or grandparents because of the coronavirus problem. So a lot of people are figuring out how to make Pesach. I don't know how many of you that's shayach for, but if you have any questions about that, again, feel free to ask it. One thing that's also very important this year is the idea of Mos Chitin, that you're supposed to give before Pesach a charity to help people who cannot afford to make Pesach. And especially this year, there are people who were not planning on it. They don't really have the extra cash on hand to make Pesach. So it's important to be extra diligent this year in giving even more than in other years, if possible, for Mos Chitin. The OU is collecting, the JCC is collecting. Of course, if you'd like to give to the rabbi's discretionary fund of Arshul, that's another way that you could fulfill the custom of giving Mos Chitim, and we will ensure, all of these organizations will ensure that your money is distributed in a proper fashion. This year especially, people are very stressed out, so we have to remind people that you should do the minimum that's required halachically, that a lot of people go far out on Pesach. They do all the they do their spring cleaning instead of cleaning just for Pesach. So we have to remember the famous expression that dust is not chametz. That if you see dust lying around, you don't have to be concerned that it's chametz, and feel free to completely ignore that. Even if there are a few particles of chametz mixed in your dust, it's not a problem because it's no longer edible. It's in very, very minute quantities. And we will not have to be concerned about that at all. Focus on getting the kitchen in a way that is kosher for a Pesach, and the rest of the apartment can slide. Of course, you have to clean normally to get remnants of real chametz out. But one should especially this year make an effort not to go crazy. Also, normally we try to recommend that you try to get new utensils for Pesach as opposed to koshering ones you already have. So this year, it's you could definitely, again, halachically, it's fine to do it any year, but it's important that you could definitely kosher your utensils this year more than other years. They will not be koshering in the shuls. Breuers usually has koshering. Sometimes I think Mount Sinai also. So one should make sure that you do it at home in a way that's halachically acceptable. The easiest way, often, if you have a vessel that's made all of metal, so often the easiest way to kosher it is, instead of worrying about boiling water, just put it in the oven. That if you put it, if it can withstand this temperature. I'm not advocating doing this for vessels that might get discolored. You have to know your own kitchen. But for many things, that if you just put it in the oven and you turn the oven up to the highest setting, 550 degrees, say, and you leave it in the oven until the vessel reaches the temperature of the oven, 550 degrees, for, say, half an hour to an hour. So that is a fully acceptable way of koshering pots, baking tins, again, assuming that they get cleaned this way. If they don't, the chametz, there's actually chametz stuck on them. So then this wouldn't work, but that's a nice way of koshering, and easier than boiling water, especially because if you have a large pot, say, that doesn't fit completely inside another pot to kosher it. So the way you're supposed to kosher the pot is, of course, you leave it unused for 24 hours, and then you boil water in the pot. And then since the water doesn't go all the way to the top of the pot for the koshering, so you're supposed to throw in a boiling, glowing hot stone, and you throw it into the pot, and then the water bubbles up and overflows over the sides. That koshers the pot, because the rule is that the water has to touch the entire pot, at least the inner surface of the pot. So since that's difficult for most people, then the libun kal, the putting it in the oven, is another option. But for silverware, silverware is very easy. You leave it unused for 24 hours, and the pot that you use to kosher should also be unused for 24 hours and clean. And then you boil up water in the pot, and then you drop the silverware into the pot. It could be one by one. The silverware only has to be in the pot for a very brief amount of time. You don't have to leave it in the water. You just dip it in the water. And sometimes the water cools off when you dip the silverware in the pot. Or you're dipping a smaller pot in a larger pot, sometimes the water has to be strongly boiling the whole time. So you let it go back to a strong boil after putting the silverware in a pot, and then you could remove the silverware or the smaller pot or whatever vessels you're koshering right away. You don't have to let it sit in the water. Another thing I would remind people is that you don't have to kosher things that have not been used with chametz. So, for example, we have these glass pitchers. So glass is a whole thing. So Sfardim have it good with glass. That glass, they don't have to kosher glass at all for Pesach. Okay, but for Ashkenazim, the minhag is not to use glass things that have been used with hot chametz. But let's say you have a pitcher that comes to your chametz table and it's just used for water or for cold drinks. And you might wash it in a chametz sink, but it doesn't really come into any contact with hot chametz. So therefore, technically speaking, you would just be allowed to wash that off and not kosher it, even for Ashkenazim, and use it for Pesach. I was listening to hear a clip that another rabbi was talking about. Somebody asked him about a Brita filter, using the same Brita filter for Pesach. So he said, buy a new one. So I think that's good advice for a normal year. You can afford it. You have a lot of space. Maybe you have more mental energy to organize these things. So he said, buy a new one for Pesach. So, but I think for this year especially, so a Brita filter or something like that is not actually used with hot chametz at all ever, then one is not required to kosher that at all for Pesach. You could just wash it off. Also, we personally, people are talking about koshering kiddush cups. So we personally are careful the whole year, it's a good advice to everyone, that we do not wash our kiddush cups in the vicinity of hot chametz. So there's challah in the sink, we don't put our kiddush cups there, and we hardly ever wash the kiddush cups in hot water anyway, so we don't kosher our kiddush cups for Pesach. And again, especially for this year, if it's difficult for people, there might be room to be lenient about that as well, just to clean them very thoroughly without a requirement of koshering in hot water. There was also a discussion about using products from during the year without a kosher certification for Pesach, since there might be shortages this year, could you use, let's say, a regular product that's labeled gluten-free, so it clearly doesn't have any derivatives of chametz, without an official certification for Pesach? So there, technically speaking, there might be room to be make on that in consultation with the kashrus agencies, but as far as I'm aware, there is, in fact, no shortage of Pesach products, and therefore the situation from regular years should apply this year, that we should be try to be careful to use only products for Pesach that have an official Pesach certification. Again, if there would be some sort of emergency situation, then there might be room to be make on that as well. But as far as I've heard so far, there is no major emergency. If anybody has a particularly difficult situation, feel free to contact me about that. There is a lot of confusion as well about the tovelin kalim. So apparently, a lot of people are nervous about sharing the kalim mikvah with people, even though the kalim mikvah is, it's brominated or chlorinated, so that's supposed to kill all germs. So people are nervous about using the kalim mikvah to tovel things because of the health crisis. So are we required still to immerse our newly acquired vessels that we might be buying for Pesach in the mikvah, assuming it's made of the material that would be problematic, including metal and the glass? The simple answer is, as far as I can tell, again, if anybody has a particular concern, feel free to contact me, but the risk of transmission... Nice to see you, by the way. I wasn't expecting you here, so all the way from Israel, so thanks for coming to our virtual meeting.
I figured I'll stay up and I'll see a lot of my friends and have an opportunity to wish everybody a Chag Kosher and Sameach, and to wish you Mazel Tov, because when I looked at my unsent emails, I found that I had a Mazel Tov message that somehow never got sent.
Okay, Shkoyach, thank you.
Okay. Well, it's good to see those of you who have allowed cameras to work, and wishing everybody a Chag Kosher v'Sameach.
Thank you. Same to you. You might have another opportunity. Hopefully, we might have another meeting of this nature. So we'll have to see what happens. Okay. So tovelin, what are we talking about? So as far as I can understand from the experts, the risk of transmission from a kelim mikvah is extremely low. Most of the kelim mikvahs, some kelim mikvahs have completely closed, which is... I'm not an expert, but it sounds a bit extreme to me. Those that have stayed open have recommended wearing gloves or have required wearing gloves. So these seem all reasonable precautions. Of course, washing hands very well before and after to using the kelim mikvah. But under normal circumstances, one indeed should still tovel one's kelim. The only possible option for those who really do not feel comfortable using the kelim mikvah or are not going out at all because they're really immunocompromised, the option would really be that one would have to give the vessel as a present to a non-Jew and then borrow it back. And since the non-Jew still owns it, so you don't have to tovel it. But the Shulchan Aruch brings this as a potential solution when there's really no ability to tovel one's kelim, but it should not normally be relied upon under normal circumstances, even this year. Selling chametz. So normally, in terms of selling chametz, we try to do it in person, because there's this minhag that when you appoint someone as a shliach, which is what you do when you appoint me to sell your chametz, you're appointing me as a messenger to sell your chametz for you. You're not selling me your chametz. I'm not interested in buying any chametz. That's a common misconception. You don't sell the rabbi your chametz. So you appoint me as a messenger to sell your chametz. So you do a kinyan, that in order that you lift up my pen, in order, it's like it strengthens the seriousness of the transaction. That yeah, I really mean it, that I'm appointing you a messenger to sell my chametz. So that is not halakhically required. Technically speaking, all you have to do is just make it known that you appoint the person to be a messenger. So therefore, this year, when things are crazy and people are not meeting in person, so that's why the online form is a perfectly acceptable option. In fact, you don't need any forms. You don't need any. You just have to verbally authorize me to sell your chametz. The reason we do a form, and in regular years we did a paper form that we could actually present to the non-Jew, is that it makes it more real for him. It could be a her also, but it's usually him. That makes it more real for the non-Jew when he has actual documents testifying to the fact that he now owns these people's chametz. He can look it up. He can look in his records, find out who it is. So instead, this year, presumably we'll give the non-Jew access to all the online forms, and he'll be able to look it up online, which will also be pretty good. If you have a particular situation, I know someone already contacted me that she is ill, possibly with coronavirus, so she doesn't know her Pesach plans yet, if she wants to rent out her whole apartment or not. That normally when people go away for the whole Pesach, so what you want to do is rent out the whole apartment, so it obviates you from the requirement of doing bedikas chametz, of checking for chametz, because the non-Jew essentially is now the temporary renter of the property, so it's not really your responsibility. So if you have a particularly pressing situation such as that, so then you could submit the form a little closer to Pesach, but we want to try to get everything done as far in advance as possible, which is why I recommended that it should be submitted in the next couple days. Shabbos HaGodol. So Shabbos HaGodol won't really be Shabbos HaGodol. There's not going to be a Shabbos HaGodol drasha, presumably, unless things shape up really, really fast. So you should go over the Haggadah. There is a minhag that we study the Haggadah on Shabbos HaGodol in order to prepare for Pesach, which is especially important this year, that there won't be any shiurim or Pesach-related discussion that will be happening communally in shul. In terms of Hamotzi, so a lot of people want a kasher for Pesach before Shabbos HaGodol, so they want to use something that is kasher to Pesach for Hamotzi, but they're in a bind, because a lot of people don't eat matzah starting either Purim or Rosh Chodesh, and they don't want to have chametz because they don't want to have chametz in the house. So what should they do? Egg matzah is one solution. That you have egg matzah, which is not, even though the Ashkenazi minhag is that healthy people do not eat egg matzah on Pesach, you're allowed to have it in your house. You're allowed to use it on your Pesach dikah dishes. So but since that's not real matzah, so certainly any minhag not to eat it from Rosh Chodesh or from Purim would not apply to egg matzah, and you will be allowed to use certainly egg matzah for hamotzi during the Shabbos HaGodol. So the egg matzah is interesting; it's really mizonos because it's very sweet and it has a different texture and consistency from regular matzah. So it's really mizonos. But when you eat it in the context of a Shabbos Suda, so we apply the rule of Koveya Suda, that when you take a cake, for example, and you use it as your main bread stuff during a meal, so the bracha switches from mezonos to hamotzi. So that would be the case with egg matzah as well. You take your two egg matzahs, you make hamotzi, and you use the egg matzah as the bread stuff in the course of the meal, even though it's really mezonos. So then you would make hamotzi on it. You could use it for the Sudas of Shabbos HaGodol. If you don't have access to egg matzah and you don't want chametz in your house because of the crazy situation, then you could even use regular Pesach matzah. Again, the halacha is that you're only not allowed to eat matzah on Erev Pesach. The stuff before, the either from Rosh Chodesh or from Purim, is only minag. It's only custom. So if you want to break the minag on a temporary basis just for 1 year because of the crazy situation, then one would be allowed to use even regular matzah and breaking one's minhag just on a temporary basis, which is allowed. If you want to completely change your minhag, then you have to have hataras nadar. You have to formally annul the vow, but one would be allowed to use regular matzah. Somebody wrote in the group chat, all the kela mikvahs near me are all closed. So going back to what we were discussing before with Tvilas Kalim, so I believe the gentleman who wrote this comment lives near the ocean, correct? No? Not so close? I can't hear you because your microphone is off. Yeah?
It's about 45 minutes away.
Okay, so you drive 25 minutes. You go to the ocean. Yeah, so they can't keep you off the beach. You'll probably be 6 feet away from other people.
They shut the beaches down here.
Oh, yeah?
They go to the spring breakers and they're keeping them closed.
Uh-huh. Okay, you have a problem. Okay. You have an issue. So try to use vessels that do not require tevila, like plastic or disposable aluminum. According to most poskim, doesn't have to be tovel. But if you could get to a beach, I don't know, or a natural lake or something where you'll be the only person there and there's not really a concern for social contact, so then the beach will be the next best thing to tovel in the ocean. Okay, so the siyum. So one issue that a lot of people are wondering about, so people who are firstborns, so how will you be allowed to eat on Erev Pesach? We know that the minhag is that people have fast. You fast on Erev Pesach unless you go to a Sudas Mitzvah. So either you go to a Siyum or even a Bris. Bris is actually better because that's really a Sudas Mitzvah at the correct time. The Siyum is sort of, you can make any time. You're just choosing to make it on Erev Pesach to get out of the fasting. But, so what are you going to do? So, brisin are supposed to be limited this year to immediate family only. And siyumim are obviously not really happening in shul because there are no services. So the best thing would really be, those who are firstborn, is to make a siyum yourself. You don't need a minion for a siyum. So learn a short masechta of Gemara. The minhag is that you only make a siyum when you learn a whole tractate of Gemara. Or you learn a Seder, a whole Seder of Mishnah. So that's a little bit of a flexible minhag. So people who are not so used to learning, and it's really a lot of an effort for them to learn even a tractate of Mishnah, so there's room to be lenient on making a Siyum even for a tractate of Mishnah. So depending on where your level of learning is, if you learn a whole Masechta of Gemara, or even a Masechta of Mishnah, or a Seder of Mishnah, then you'll be allowed to make your own private Siyum on Erev Pesach. You don't have to have anyone else there, and that would allow you to eat. So what happens if you're just not going to happen? The Poskim now have been lenient that one could participate with a Siyum on Zoom. So using this lovely platform that we're using right now, so I'm sure the OU, I'm sure other Jewish organizations will be sending out links to join a Zoom Siyum meeting. So you could join a Siyum over Zoom or even a conference call. And since you're participating some way in the learning of Torah that's represented by that Siyum, so that would allow you to eat on Erev Pesach. And what happens if both of these options are just not going to happen? So this year, since there's a health crisis, and anyway, it's very difficult for most people to fast on Erev Pesach and then break your fast with a large cup of wine, and then be on an empty stomach with a large cup of wine until a second cup of wine, and then to eat a lot of matzah. It could affect your performance of mitzvahs at the Seder. So based on all these considerations, one would not need to fast this year. On Erev Pesach, even if you cannot make it to a Siyum, you would just make a donation to Tzedakah instead of participating in the Siyum. Now, what about the Seder itself? So we have a bit of an issue. Let's go back one second. So first of all, I saw a very inspiring story today that was being publicized around. You can read it. You go to www.rabbidunner.com. That's Rabbi D-U-N-N-E-R. He's a very fascinating individual. He's a bit of a historian. He's a rabbi in Beverly Hills, Rabbi Pinny Dunner. And he writes about Jewish history and inspirational things that come out of Jewish history. So he writes that when the Lubavitcher Rebbetzin died, so she died a couple months before Pesach, and that year the Lubavitcher Rebbe ate his Seder alone. So people were wondering why he would do that. He obviously had tens of thousands of people at his beck and call, that he would easily have been able to join another Seder or to have people come to him if necessary, if he wanted to. But instead, he specifically chose to have the Seder completely alone. That's depressing. That's, why would he choose to do that? So some have suggested, Rabbi Dunner quotes, that he did this specifically because he foresaw that there might be situations in the future where people would be forced to have a Seder alone, and he wanted to give them chizuk. He He wanted to strengthen their happiness and to say that if the Lubavitcher Rebbe could do it and have the Seder alone, so I could do it as well. So again, it will be very challenging for those who have to have the Seder alone. Again, depending on the guidelines of the health department, so it may be okay to have a small starim, two, three people instead of people mamishalim, but there could be people who are in the situation that they have it alone, so they have to realize that their Seder is meaningful, and it is trying, but we know that there will be a lot of reward for observing the Seder properly, even in very trying circumstances. There are no real changes if you have to do the Seder alone. You even say the Manishtana by yourself. So you're not really asking anyone any questions, but you're just pointing it out by yourself. There are people who have the minhag. It's not the minhag of our shul. It's not the standard Ashkenazi minhag. But there are people who have the minhag to say halal in shul before the Seder. Mostly Sfardim, Hasidim have this minhag. I wrote about it. If you want to look up on Torah Musings, so you can look up an article I have about the halal on the Seder night in shul. So there's a major question as to whether this halal is only supposed to be recited, again, for those who have the minhag at all. For regular Ashkenazim, it's not an issue because you never say halal at that shul anyway. It would only be at the Seder. But for those who have the minhag to recite the halal before the Seder in shul, would you do it anyway if you're alone? So the normative psak that Alpi Kabbalah is that yes, one would recite halal with a bracha before the Seder even while alone. That's the standard psak. However, for Ashkenazim who are not very stark in this minhag, again, if you're not a real practicing chassid that does things alpi Kabbalah, or not a real practicing Sfardi, so I would recommend that one not do this, because there is a question as to whether this halal is intended to be recited, even if it is not in a minyan, even in Betzior. The Seder has to be started after Tzeisa Kochavim, after nightfall. So normally this isn't even an issue because people go to shul, and by the time they get home, so it's after nightfall already. So you're starting the Seder by default after nightfall. But nowadays, you know, I'm just imagining, thinking back to the last couple of Shabbosos. So my wife lit candles at the normal time, and then we said Kabbalah Shabbos and we daven Ma'ariv. And then you start the meal right away. What are you waiting for? You don't need to wait for Tzeis HaKochavim to start the Shabbos meal. But now, what? You're gonna light the candles. You're gonna daven Ma'ariv on the first night of the Seder, and then what? You're gonna sit around for 45 minutes, approximately 40 minutes, whatever, 45 minutes before you are allowed to start the Seder. So how do you entertain yourself? Any ideas? I told my wife this idea. See, yes, right, Lock, yeah?
Hey, join me here. We don't have any such problem. Between sunset and nightfall, it's about 20 minutes.
Okay. Yep. Okay, in Eretz Yisrael, it's a little faster. Yeah, okay, but you still might have a few minutes then today. If you daven before Shkia, you could daven Ma'ariv before Shkia if you want. Yeah. So how do you entertain yourself? So I told my wife this idea today, and at first she was scandalized, but then it grew on her. So you start the Seder with Chad Gadya. You start with Nirtza first. Okay, Nirtza doesn't really mean the conclusion of the Seder. I've spoken about that before. But the so-called Nirtza, the songs after the Seder. So start with the songs. And my kids will be still awake then, hopefully. So They'll enjoy the song. So you start straight from what's the first song afterwards in Ashkenazi Agadah, V'amartem Zevach Pesach Kilo Noe, all those songs. So by the time you finish all those songs, Adirhu Echad Miodeah, by the time you finish all those songs, it'll be time to start the Seder for real with the Kiddush. Those who are really in a pinch maybe can make Kiddush a few minutes earlier than the time that's announced on the that'll be announced in the email and that's been announced on the shul website, and a few minutes earlier, not too much earlier. That's one thing to keep in mind. The next thing is that if you happen to be Chas V'Shalom, I hope we all stay well, everybody. whose video I can see now looks very chipper. I'm hoping that's the my assessment is correct. So I hope everyone is doing very well. But if people are not feeling well, or are caring for someone who's not feeling well, then there is room to abridge certain parts of the Seder. So the first thing that will go would be, even though it's everyone's favorite part, can you imagine a Seder without Dayenu? But Dayenu, and where it says Amar Rabbi Yossi, and it talks about the Makos. What does it say? The talk is comparing the Makos, the plagues that were in at the actual land of Egypt, to the plagues that the Egyptians suffered on the sea. So that whole section from there until Amar Rabban Gamliel, that talking about Pesach Matzah Maros, you could skip that. The most important parts to say are Avodim Hayinu and Amar Rabban Gamliel and the Pesach Matzah Maror and the parts of the Halal and all the brachas, of course. So those are the most important. The Arami Oved Avi would be next in line. Okay, so I want to... they might be cutting me off in a couple minutes because this thing only, I think, supports 40 minutes. So does anybody have any questions or comments at this time? Again, if not, you could... I hope people have comments now, but if you want to think of any other topics to discuss, I'll be happy to do another Zoom session in the next few days. Yeah, question.
Can Maariv be davened early, just like the Shabbos?
Yeah, on the first night of the Seder, you could definitely daven Maariv after Plag, but then you're just going to have a longer break between Maariv and when you're allowed to start the Seder. Yeah. The second night of Pesach, so it is proper to wait until Tzeis to daven Maariv. It's not absolutely required, but it is proper to daven Maariv after Tzeis. And then Friday night again, so it's a three-day Yontif. So Friday evening, you could again daven Maariv after Plag because Shabbos is holier than Yontif, so it's okay to take away from Yontif in honor of Shabbos. Then Motzei Shabbos, you should again wait until Tzeis for Maariv. Also remember to make an Erev Tavshilin, Erev Pesach, as it goes into Shabbos.